in academia, one which pertains, I think, a little bit more to graduate students than undergraduate students, but it can apply to all students, and that's the issue of authorship. Here again, because this is such a difficult and prevalent issue, we have devoted a larger time frame to discuss it, and we have two case studies dealing with slightly different aspects of it. And here to present the first case study is Professor Andy Large from the School of Information Studies, who's also the Associate Dean, Research and Graduate Studies in the Faculty of Education. He's also the editor of one journal and a member of the editorial boards of several other journals, and therefore he is particularly well-placed to lead us in a discussion of authorship. So with that, we'll put up the first case study.
Thank you. I'm sorry to be the one who brought you back from your eating and drinking to sit at the tables. The case studies we've heard so far this morning all have to do in some way or another with authorship. I mean, they're all relevant to authorship. But in this section, the two case studies that myself and Kathleen are going to introduce to you talk about the specific issue of who should be an author and what qualifies you to be an author. And what qualifies you to be positioned in the list of authors in a certain place. Because although it's still the case that there are individuals who work alone, who produce a publication with little or no involvement from anyone else, increasingly in most, if not all, disciplines, work is being done by teams. So teams are generating research findings, and that raises some new issues of authorship. And I think in a university context, that is overlaid with another problem, and that is a problem of, I don't know what you want to call it, power structures or hierarchies, but we can have in a team undergraduates, conceivably, but certainly master's students, PhDs, postdocs. We can have assistant professors, associate professors, full professors, and of course we can have supervisors and supervised. And I think that lends more potential problems, produces more potential problems in terms of looking at authorship. So I have here, I think it's maybe the shortest case study of the morning. So this is, you can read it yourself, it relates to a graduate student, who has done some work for his supervisor. The supervisor has drawn upon that work in a publication, but then the supervisor doesn't believe that Douglas should have any claim to authorship. So the first question is, should Douglas be included as an author? So what do you think? Maybe some of you have been in this position, I don't know.
We're going to get away from the clickers for a moment, just to change things around.
What do you think of the salient points? What should we consider when we're trying to decide whether a contribution is worthy of having that person placed in the list of authors?
Anybody? Anybody think they should be an author? Anybody who's shaking their head want to speak? Okay. Great. Mike is coming.
Same situation. He's done research that was used in the paper, so it should be an author.
Okay. Any counter views? I think that maybe the two questions are, what type of contribution was it, and what was the extent of the contribution? It's interesting. I'm not sure that universities are so much looking at this issue. It's more publishers and editors of journals who are beginning to look at this issue. So I think we've provided it somewhere, but there's a quote here from the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors. And it says, an author is generally considered to be someone who has made substantive intellectual contributions to a published study. Each author should have participated sufficiently in the work to take public responsibility for appropriate portions of the content. And then I'll just read you a second one. This is from the American Psychological Association, open letter to authors for APA journals. Psychologistic responsibility and credit, including authorship credit, only for work they have actually performed or to which they have substantially contributed. So I think the question here is, was what kind of contribution was Douglass's? And although it's a rather short case study, I think there are a series of other questions we might want to ask if Douglass and the supervisor were with us. The first one is, I think, exactly how extensive is the literature review? Yeah? It could range from Douglass being sent off and finding a number of references that he delivers to the professor. It could pass through that to maybe Douglass producing an annotated bibliography, so he says a little bit about what is in each of the references he found. And it could go through to Douglass having done a fairly extensive literature review that could be built in as a first part of an article or a grant application, because normally both require some sort of literature review. So I think one question is to try to disentangle exactly what did he do, and at what point does that justify authorship rather than some other kind of recognition?
So maybe we should get a little more specific. If he should be an author, first or second author, and if he's not supposed to be an author, if we don't think he has to be an author given what he's done, is there another way in which it is common practice to recognize the contribution of such a student? So for those of you who think he's an author, do most of you think he should be a second author? I mean, does anybody think he should be the first author? Oh, I hear a lot. I see a lot of heads shaking no. Any yeses? So maybe consensus is that if he should be an author, it's a second author. What else can the professor do? The supervisor do? What else can we do? Acknowledge how? Anybody? I'm sorry? At the end? Okay. Well, I'll tell you what I do is right under my name, I put a little asterisk, and it comes before the first footnote. So the little asterisk goes down, and it says, you know, Professor, Faculty of Law, McGill University, I would like to thank the blah, blah, blah trust for giving me this grant, which made possible the research assistance of... and I name the research assistant whose invaluable contribution, without whose invaluable contribution I could not have produced this article. I do that. I do that for everything I ever publish. I acknowledge the work of my research assistants. Is that enough? David?
You could even specify the kind of work, who prepared an invaluable bibliography or a literature review for the purposes of this paper.
Now, again, a comment, sorry to butt in, but a comment that was made earlier by someone from Table 6, a very good comment, is that a lot of what's going on here is discipline-specific, right? So, again, Professor Lametti and I are sort of taking this, wearing our hats as law professors, and maybe even more broadly as those teaching in the humanities. And we don't often have a number of authors, right? In fact, I've only had one publication that I've ever co-authored with, no, two publications that I've ever co-authored with anybody, and they've both been colleagues and professors with me. So it's a little bit of a different story. Maybe those of you who are in the sciences, where there is more of a tendency to have multiple authors, including authors, students and grad students who do contribute in some way to the work, maybe that's what's leading us into maybe different directions. Anybody want to say something? Malcolm, we have to get you a mic. Thanks, Steve.
In the sciences, there are two types of publications. One is, of course, a publication of actual research results you gained performed in the lab. But there's also review articles, reviews of your field. And... you know, sometimes it's very tempting when a student hands in a particularly good review of a research area, you can maybe work that up into a review article, a review of a subject. And so then, in those cases, I think a contributing student author should be an author. But unless a student in a research publication has contributed substantially to the acquisition of data, the interpretation of data, and the discussion of the data, then I think authorship mm-hmm. in that case would not be appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Right. There was some colleagues at McGill, I've heard them say that if they're established professors, established researchers, and they say it's normally my policy to put my students as first authors because I want to advance their careers and I don't need to do that. So there are the counterpoint of view are people who say, if I'm supervising a student, I inevitably have, if I'm doing a good job, I inevitably have an impact on what is being done, and therefore doesn't that always mean I have at least a reasonably significant contribution? Doesn't that always make me an author on anything they write, and maybe not the first author? And I'm probably running out of time, but just to leave you with some thoughts, do you think it makes any difference if the student is paid for his work or her work? In Douglas's case, his work. Does that affect the matters? Does it make any difference if Douglas has done it for credit as an academic exercise rather than as a research assistant? So these are all issues that float around. Am I out of time now?
No, I think you are, but that was really a great ending to this. Is there anybody else who would like to comment?
Just a quick point that I worked as an RA for a number of years.
And, you worked as a?
As a research assistant
an RA,
for a number
sorry.
Of years. And, you know, if we followed the idea that anybody who attributes anything to the data, I would have been in every publication that allowed produced because I collected all the data. And, of course, I wasn't. I think that was quite reasonable. I was listed on papers in which I actually made something more than just collecting data. So in the case of pay, I think it's reasonable to say I paid you for your work. And if your work consisted of something, you know, fairly non-intellectual, you know, fair enough, you don't get on. And then, of course, if you contribute a bit more, paid or not paid, you deserve credit for it.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. So another gray area. Professor Lametti.
Just adding a copyright law parallel on authorship, because copyright goes to the initial author. We're getting to you on that. The test in at least the Anglo-Canadian tradition is independent mind. So if you're being directed closely by your supervisor, you wouldn't have a claim, at least in copyright terms. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean authorship, but at least in copyright terms, you wouldn't have a claim. Whereas if you begin to exercise independent mind and you have latitude, then perhaps you at least have a copyright claim. Now, that might help us with respect to authorship.
One final word would be... I would always recommend the team that is doing the work to discuss these kinds of issues before the article is submitted. I mean, that it's worth talking about who's going to have what role and how it's going to be dealt with in any manuscripts that are produced to try to minimize conflict and the shock of suddenly seeing the proofs and finding your name is not on it or is last on the list.
Absolutely. Again, to wear my legal hat, a priori is always better than ex post facto. With that, I'd like to thank Professor Large and invite our Professor Kathleen Glass. Because we're going to have an opportunity to continue on discussing issues with respect to authorship. And this time, we have created a fact scenario that deals with lab work. And that's going to lead us in the discussion of this slightly more complicated case study. We're fortunate to have Professor Kathleen Glass from the Department of Human Genetics and Pediatrics. And she's also someone who's a member and former director of the Biomedical Ethics Unit. She's a clinical ethicist at the Montreal Children's Hospital and has served on numerous McGill and Hospital Research Ethics Board. So with that, I'm going to ask Professor Glass to take us through our final case study on authorship.
Thank you very much. You'll see that a bit of this overlaps with what we've just done, but there's some new issues too. So take a read on this case and see what you think of it. It's involving graduate students. It's, I see we have this up here. It's in a lab kind of an environment, which maybe many of you are in, but it could easily be transferable maybe to another kind of a research group. There are a variety of different kinds of people working under the same sort of general umbrella of a grant from a professor. So it's senior colleagues, junior colleagues, students, etc. So people are going to have different perspectives on actually, I think, on who's responsible for what and who actually should be an author on the work. that our graduate student, Mary, really is sort of been the major player on. So we're going to go back to the clickers, and there are a variety of suggestions of who should be the author.
Maybe I'll read them out because these are very, very small. So you're going to vote for A if you believe that you should limit lab authorship, to those who came to the weekly lab meetings and discussed work with Mary. That's option one. Option two, you're going to vote for option B if you want to limit authorship to Mary, her supervisor, and one or two senior scientists involved with other or different aspects of the project that are included in the grant. You're going to vote for C if you think that Mary should have sole authorship. And her argument for sole authorship is that although the original ideas for the project included important input from her supervisor, she's gone beyond that proposal and has made an important and original contribution herself. And, you know, if both names go on, well, they're going to think it's his work, not hers. And then you're going to vote D if the supervisor wants his clinical colleague to be an author because she provided the images and clinical data about the patients. So we're going to give you a little more time for this one because there's complex choices. This is your gut feel. We're then going to discuss it. It's a gut feel, but again, who should be authors? Everyone who came to the lab meetings and discussed the work with Mary. Mary, her supervisor, and one or two senior scientists. Mary alone, or some clinical colleagues who provided images and clinical data. We'll come back to this, but it's just your gut feel. Wow. And we have a winner. Okay. So most of you, at least, don't want Mary alone to be the author. That's easy. Most of you do want Mary, her supervisor, and just one or two senior scientists involved to be the authors. So now, Professor Kathleen Glass is going to complicate things or elucidate us. I'm not one of the two.
Well, I mean, we might ask, how can we get some help in resolving what might be an issue? And also, I'm not sure how much, and we can talk about this in the discussion, how much your voting reflects the actual practice in your own research groups or labs. So that will be interesting to know. We do have a bit of help, and Professor Larch mentioned this, that in the context of medical research in any case, there is a group called the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors, and they have come up with some guidelines that on who actually should be an author. Whether these guidelines are actually followed in practice completely or not, I think, is a question. But they say that authorship credit should be based on substantial contributions to conception and design, acquisition of data, analysis, and interpretation of data. And maybe in the discussion we can talk about how you might actually characterize substantial and whether that's something we can argue about. Drafting the article or revising it critically for important intellectual content. So you needn't necessarily be the person who does the first draft in order to be an author, but you do have to be doing something that is contributing to the intellectual content. And then the third thing is with an and, it's not an or, and you should be willing to give final approval, or you should have given final approval, to the version that gets published. I think it makes clear that just having brought in the funding isn't sufficient to make a person an author, although certainly we do hear about cases in which that is proposed as a reason for authorship. And anybody who's designated to be an author should be qualified to be an author and should fulfill these criteria of one, two, and three. So I guess I'd like to know from you before we do any kind of a revote whether any of the issues that might have been controversial for Mary are ones that are actually live issues for you. Are there any cases in which you think it can be unclear? Do you find it easy to define what's substantial, what's not substantial? Is it still the custom in many labs to just put everybody's name on the paper? Those kinds of things.
Well, we'll open the floor. I've seen some heads shaking and nodding. Who would like to begin the discussion? Anybody? Okay, table 17, thanks.
I've spent most of my research career working in clinical environments, and I think it is very, very common practice to put somebody from the clinical side of things on the paper, whether or not they knew what was going on before the paper was actually written or not. And this is a bit of a practical issue where they're providing you with the patients and you're just required to do it in order to keep their cooperation. Although I will say also that generally they will see a version of the paper and review it, even if not necessarily really extensively. But I mean, whether or not that's ideally appropriate that, you know, some doctor gets listed on every single paper you publish because he's a patient, maybe not. But I guess it's just a fact of life that we kind of are forced to live with.
Do you think, I mean, so you're insinuating it doesn't really meet these criteria for authorship, at least the ones that have been proposed?
I think it may not quite reach them, though. I mean, they will review the paper usually once, just sometime before the final draft. Mm-hmm. And by that point, they usually don't have a lot to contribute anymore because it's been reviewed by the student, by the professor, by possibly other lab members, and it's been quite thoroughly worked out. So, you know, there's not much left for them to actually change or put in. Although, in other times, you know, they said MD or whoever might actually make a contribution in another paper. But anyway, sometimes I think that maybe they get added when, you know, their contribution has actually been quite minimal and maybe they don't quite meet the criteria.
You know, this again raises the divide between different faculties, different disciplines. And sometimes I end up sitting, as you will all, on review committees, tenure review committees, in other faculties. And, you know, here I am from the Faculty of Law, and then I come to sit on the University Tenure Committee in the Faculty of Science, and I'm going, really? He has 225 publications? Huh? Because, of course, that wouldn't be possible in the Faculty of Law. But, of course, as the student commentator just pointed out, if the practice in that area or the practice in that journal, and maybe you want to talk to us about different practices in different journals, is to put that doctor's name down on every publication because they provided the patients, well, then, yeah, you're going to have all those publications. So, again, this is something that can be very specific to different disciplines, but... It's a very touchy issue. And I think another thing that you've raised, maybe I read too much into it, is that when we were thinking about the issue of authorship, we were thinking of people who weren't being made authors but who were mad that they weren't on a list of authorship. You actually raised the flip side of the coin, which is you can be put as an author but not necessarily want to be there because maybe you contributed something at the inception of this project, but maybe it went off in a direction that you're not particularly proud of, and then your name is there. So it's actually two sides.
Right. For maybe political reasons.
Professor McKenzie.
I think I might want to disagree with your number B. Most everybody voted for B. B bothers me. Could we have B back up there again? Because I think you were sneaky on the B.
Oh, come on.
Well, actually, it's the next slide because we're going to vote again. Okay, so just go to the next slide.
Okay. It's Mary wants to limit authorship to herself or supervisor, one or two senior. Is that the one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Scientists
and what I take exception with is the part that says, and one or two senior scientists involved with other different aspects of the project that are included in the grant. So this is mixing in a big grant on which there are several grant holders and different projects within the grant. So what I wasn't clear about on your question, if these senior people are on parts B and C in the grant and the paper is on part A, they don't belong. Because they really didn't do anything except to write the part of a grant that belonged to them. So I thought maybe you put that in there to trick us, but I wasn't sure.
So which one would you vote for? Oh.
I would vote for B, provided you took
the two other senior scientists off, right.
Because from what you're saying, it sounds like they didn't really belong to that part of the research.
No, that was intentional.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
No, you raise a very good point, because they certainly wouldn't have fulfilled, probably wouldn't have fulfilled those three requirements for authorship if we want to go with those. I mean, people might say those criterion for authorship from the journal editors aren't appropriate. One of the questions I was interested in is this issue of research group custom or lab custom, or in the last presentation, there was talk of what's custom among law professors. I mean, is it possible, or should we be looking to break down some of that custom if it doesn't really appear to be appropriately crediting people who should get credit, or not crediting people who shouldn't get credit?
Great. We have a comment. Table 18. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. It relates very much to what you just said. We, coming from another country, we find transcultural differences. And I think this is a crucial issue, particularly with authorship. There are some countries where the head of the department obliges the researcher to have their name on the paper. There are sometimes people, situations like the grant, even if they didn't put nothing into the paper because they were part of the submission people, then they have to be on the paper. So these are things that also are on stake upon this authorship issue. So it would be great if we could learn a bit from there.
I cannot tell you how happy I am you made that comment, because going back to the days when I was Dean of Students, and again, I'm going back to the plagiarism issue, and I wonder if the current Dean of Students gets this today, but you have no idea how many times I would get a student saying, "What do you mean this is plagiarism? Where I come from, this is not plagiarism. Where I come from, it is customary to take ideas or not attribute or not be so picky about quotations. And indeed, that is we take that to be the truth. When students do come from other cultures where there are different standards. So that's a really good general question that applies not only to authorship, but that applies to plagiarism and indeed almost everything we're doing. To what extent is it discipline-specific? To what extent is it culture-specific? And if it is culture-specific, of course, my answer to those students always was, well, regrettably, even though that's the culture in which you were educated, when you come to McGill, you got to play by the McGill rules, because we're here now, and it's the McGill code of student conduct that applies to you, not, you know, your code of student conduct from another university. So I guess that really raises the issue of education and, again, the a priori point, dealing with this right from the outset. But that's a really, really terrific point. And just talking from plagiarism, what about from an authorship point of view?
Well, I think certainly the same thing applies, but I think that the culture might be a different one because it's from a different country, mm-hmm. or the culture might be different because it's from a different discipline, or it might be different because it's a different subject matter that you're looking at. I spent some time in Boston, I guess it was about 15 years ago, and someone from a fairly prestigious law school there told me that there was a custom in the law school that if you were a first-year student, no matter what you did on a paper, you were thanked. You got this acknowledgement thing, which I'd like to know from you what kind of value that has for you. If you were a second-year student and you had written basically the paper, then you could be second author with your prof. And then finally, when you got to be a third-year student, you could actually be first author. I mean, I think that's a custom that none of us would probably really want to support.
Not a McGill.
But according to the people who were telling me, who presumably knew, that was a custom, and hopefully that's broken down by now. So I think we have to look at customs as disciplinary, but as well look at what happens from other countries. But I would certainly agree with Professor Duke here that when you're at McGill, you do have to play by McGill rules.
Are we ready for a revote, or...? No,
just
not
maybe
yet.
One very quick.
Absolutely.
One
and
very
then,
quick comment. Yeah, I'm fascinated that 73% of you went for B. I think it shows that there aren't many group selection theorists in the room. You seem to be okay with giving credit to your supervisor and his friends, and you seem to also want to exclude your own colleagues, whom apparently you perceive as your primary competitors. Is that, am I reading this right, or am I misreading the feeling in the room here? I mean, I want you to reflect on the implications of that choice of B. I think it has some fairly deep implications about how you view your work and how you view your role and your status in the university. There's a hand over there.
We table also have 20. First, we have Professor Durham. And then table 20. Thank you.
I just want to bring up the context of writing your thesis, particularly for those of you who are in large labs and tend to work collaboratively on each other's projects, and then you want and publish together on the same in the same manuscripts, and then you want to go to your thesis and use the manuscript-based thesis. This is often becomes quite contentious because then, like, who wrote this? Especially if there are, so you have to be very careful in terms of early on saying, what is my piece of this for my thesis? How does the work that I do with other students relate to that? They are writing a thesis too. We all can't write the same thesis. That's against the rules. So you should be thinking of, okay, I'll have to be the first author. I'll have to write the paper, although people will edit it. Or then you have to say, well, I will write a conventional thesis and describe my project and be very clear about how others contributed. So think about, there's no clear answer to this, so please think about those things and discuss them in your group and with your supervisor about how, as your work gets closer and closer and closer together with other students, how each of you will address your thesis.
Great, thank you. And now we have a final comment on this from table 20.
Yeah, as far as answer B goes, I think I chose it, and probably this goes for a lot of other people as well, because there wasn't really any good answer, and that was the closest to what we feel is apt. Like, for me, I think Mary should be first author, her supervisor should be last author, and anyone else who contributed substantially to the paper should be in the middle. But that wasn't one of the options, so B was kind of the closest thing.
That's why I don't give multiple choice exams.
So, I mean, I guess when you do this, you're not supposed to really change what the questions are. So, I mean, you could say, I wish we'd added none of the above possibilities, but I don't think that's part of the way.
Well, maybe maybe it's good that we have some slight technical difficulty about revoting, so we're not going to revote. But with those very salient comments, I'm going to thank the audience, and I'm going to thank Professor Glass for this wonderful presentation.
Well, thank you.